From the Sky News Centre at 6, three schoolgirls from East London are feared to be heading to Syria to join Islamic State extremists. The 15 and 16-year-olds flew from Gatwick to Turkey on Tuesday without leaving messages for family or friends. Police say the runaways are good friends with another 15-year-old who went to Syria in December. Sadak is a family friend of one of the missing girls.
It's really sad what's happened, and I think the government should try its best to help in any way find out what happened and try to help the family as well.
Chelsea have apologised over the actions of supporters on the Paris Metro. Manager Jose Mourinho says he's ashamed of the racist chants and a black man being pushed off a train. The club spokesman Steve Atkins says the scenes were deeply upsetting.
We were appalled by what we saw. The club would also like to apologise unreservedly to Solomon for the behaviour of a small number of individuals and their unforgivable actions towards him.
A former special constable has admitted trying to murder three colleagues at a care home where she worked by poisoning them. Police say Melissa Swift's dangerous plan resulted in 32 people being put at risk in the sheltered housing complex in West Bromwich. Now, it's reported that a draft agreement's been reached to extend Greece's EU bailout. Eurozone finance ministers are meeting in Brussels to discuss the request from Athens for a six-month bridging loan. Germany initially opposed it because it didn't come with stringent austerity conditions attached. Scientists say they've come up with a type of chocolate that can smooth out wrinkles. The company that makes Esterchoc claims it can reverse the damaging effects that smoking and sun exposure have on the skin. Nick Lowe's a dermatologist.
The best approach for you is to start by protecting the skin and stop smoking. And if they're not going to do that, quite bluntly, they're wasting their money.
And in showbiz news, Rowan Atkinson is going to star in a remake of the French detective series Maid Grey. He's going to be playing the pipe-smoking Parisian detective in two feature-length episodes, which are going to be recorded for ITV. That's the latest. I'm Chris Giles.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Here, take these.
What are they?
The results of my morning's research at the British Museum. Put one in each pocket of your jacket.
And may I ask what they are?
Salt and mercury, effective against the dark forces. They will protect you and Simon, if we can save him.
And you?
I have other protection.
None of us may eat today.
Some water.
And no alcohol.
I'm sorry.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Seven protesters and police shot dead by snipers. Regime change in Kiev a year ago today, but with fascists in Kiev, who can blame the so-called bad rebels? And when banks and corporations act like they're trashing our jobs, economy, legal aid and environment, when the legal system no longer delivers justice, favouring the rich, at what point do you say enough is enough and break the law? Would you take part in peaceful civil disobedience to make your point, or maybe even turn things around? A direct action group Earth First are meeting in Bristol this weekend, and Indra Don Francesco joins me to talk about it. A third nuclear power station at Hinkley Point's looking less and less likely, and while we're on the subject of energy, does oil and gas play a part in the Ukraine conflict, just as it has in the Middle East? David Powell's coming from Friends of the Earth. Also, everything's changing in the already deliberately mysterious world of the economy. The EU is printing money and we're going into deflation. Whatever that means, prices are projected to fall. So we speak now to economics professor Steve Keen, where he says we need a Copernican revolution. Now, Steve, first of all, tell us about whereabouts you're from. And secondly, what do you mean by a Copernican revolution?
Well, I'm at Kingston University these days. I started working there as head of school about halfway through last year. And by Copernican Revolution, what I'm really talking about is the perspective that economists have on the economy, which is their framework from which they try to analyze it. And I think in many ways the best way to get parity and communicate to people what that framework is, is to say they're pretty much behaving in the same way that astronomers did before Galileo came along and said, no, it's not the Earth at the centre of the universe, it's the Sun. And rather than the planets and the Moon orbiting and the Sun orbiting around the Earth, the Earth is one of the planets orbiting the Sun. And you then have complete change in perspective.
How could they get things so wrong?
It's really because they asked themselves the question that dominated economics was first posed by a French economist called Leon Walras back in 1870. And the question he asked was, can a system of uncoordinated markets reach equilibrium? Which is an interesting intellectual puzzle. And trying to solve that puzzle has dominated the last 140 years or so of economics. When the question they should have been asked is, hey, every now and then capitalism stuffs up really badly, but other times it does rather well. Can we explain both of them? And that's the perspective that Hyman Minsky put forward about 40 or so years ago, and that's the perspective that dominates a minority school of economics that I'm part of, known as post-Keynesian economics. And it means you look at the world and you see things, you see exactly the same apparent phenomena, but you describe them completely differently. So just like Copernicans looked at the universe and saw the Sun rising around the Earth every day, and then see the Earth being incredibly stable in the center of the universe, et cetera, et cetera. The Copernican basically say, hey, the Earth is orbiting the Sun, is rotating on its axis, and the Sun appears to rise, but it's actually Earth's spin. It's not sunrise. And one is the latter is a realistic description of the solar system which we actually live in. The other is an interesting toy model that with enough tweaking actually fits the data, but doesn't describe the real world.
Okay, so what we need to know from you is, how do we have this Copernican rift? What do we need to reassess in economics? And I suppose all of our London economics correspondents as well, we hope they're going to reassess it too. What do we need to change in order to understand better the way that money works?
In a way, there are basically two major factors we need to change. One is the perspective of seeing the economy as fundamentally a system that tends towards equilibrium, which is a 19th century way of thinking. That's not the economy we live in. The economy tends to be unstable. And the second thing we need to do, and this is going to sound ridiculous to anybody who hasn't studied economics, because they think, of course, economists must do what I'm about to say they don't do, and that is we have to consider the existence of banks, debt, and money. Now, bizarrely, mainstream economics pretends they can model capitalism while ignoring the existence of banks, debt, and money. That might sound ludicrous if you haven't done an economics degree. If you have done one, it's still ludicrous, but people have been brainwashed into thinking you can analyse the economy that way.
Now, Martin, maybe you can help explain banks, debt and money. That sounds to me to be the building blocks of economics. Why isn't it such an important part of what goes on in our schools and universities?
Well, the idea is that banks and money are just like the oil in the engine, and that therefore they don't have any real influence over what happens. And of course, the basis of this leads to the idea of an equilibrium system, which tends to stability, when we know from looking at the real world that it doesn't tend to stability. I think what's interested me about your work over the years, Steve, which I have followed, is uh-huh. that your attempt to quantify and mathematicalize these insights. So, for example, in the 1998 crisis, when the Russians defaulted on their debt and long-term capital management collapsed in the US, mm-hmm. I, as a historical economist, I'm not really a mathematical economist, I'm more of a historian, I mean, that was just so obvious to anybody who'd studied Russian history that they were going to turn around and say, well, we're not paying and you can't make us because we've got nuclear weapons. And at that point, of course, the Black-Scholes theorem, which underpinned the long-term capital management philosophy, was blown out of the water. But you, I think what you're trying to do is you're trying to bring some real mathematical rigour into these critical insights. It's not just a question of broad brush painting. We've got to come up with different models, better models
exactly.
than they've got.
Yeah, I hasten to say I'm far from the only person that's tried this or is doing it right now, but what's really going on is that if you look back at the 19th century, economists like Walras and Marshall and Jevons, you can have some sympathy for them for making the decisions they did to model the economy as if it tends towards equilibrium and to ignore the financial sector. And so it's just to concentrate on this little mythical idea of a set of markets which are basically a barter system. That was, you know, given what they knew of mathematics at the time, And given mathematics itself at the time, which was far more advanced than they knew, but nothing like what we're used to in the 20th century, their decisions were sensible. But in the 1960s in particular, we started developing both the mathematics and the computing power and computing capabilities to model what we now call complex systems. And I think anybody listening would think, yeah, the economy is a complex system, and you're dead right. It's probably the most complex system that's ever existed, in so far as we're aware, in the universe. And the mathematics of analyzing a complex system actually comes down to a very strange and simple rule, and that is that a simple set of rules can give you very complex behavior. And what's called complex adaptive systems mathematics has developed over the last 50 years. Now, that necessarily, as it happens, requires you to think in a non-equilibrium way and in a dynamic way.
But anyway, Steve, I mean, one of the questions everyone listening, I would imagine, will be wanting to know from you is, what have we got to learn from what happened in 2008, and what mistakes were made then, and how can we fix it all?
Yeah, well, the last thing you have to learn is first of all, the banking sector matters. And secondly, the economy's not in equilibrium.
Okay, so what happened in your view? What happened in 2008?
This is where my own analysis is. This is the stuff which is my own contribution. And that is to say that if you include banks in your thinking, then when you borrow money from a bank, rather than somebody else having less spending money and you having more and the two cancelling out, which is the way the mainstream ignores banks, the bank puts an asset on its side, puts a liability, which is a deposit, on your side, and you spend that money into the economy. So your spending is the sum of your income from existing turnover of money plus this change in debt, and that aggregates to the national level. So a huge part of demand is not just demand from existing money, it's demand from new money created by the banking sector, lending it for people to spend. And so the economy becomes dependent, as the debt level of debt, private debt, rises over time, to the higher and higher level of change in debt. And what I saw coming back in 2005, looking at the American and Australian data in particular, was that the change in debt was hitting the scale of 15 or 20% of GDP every year, which means the private debt ratio is rising 10 to 15% per year. And you're reaching the stage where it was obvious people were going to say, can't afford to take on more debt, stop borrowing. And when they stopped borrowing, the economy would come plunging down, which is precisely what happened. So that's the main lesson. We have to look at the... And what economists do by believing you don't need to worry about the banking sector, they completely ignore the change in debt. So they didn't see this thing coming. But when you look at the data, it was like ignoring the nose on an elephant.
I mean, there's this other problem with debt growing and growing. Why can't the government, the Treasury, just make up money, spend it, on schools, hospitals, and this kind of thing? That seems to be the obvious solution, yet nobody seems to talk about it.
It is one of the solutions, because the government, what money fundamentally is a promise to pay that you accept as, cancelling a transaction between you and somebody else, that they give you that promise to pay. And the banks can create that promise to pay by putting deposit money in your account. The government creates the same by making a welfare payment, or by actually sending you cash in the mail. So it'd be quite possible for the government to do that and to reduce the reliance we have upon debt-created money. The danger in that is the possibility of the government getting involved in runaway spending, inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But people throw in your face every time you say it's a solution to the current problem, what about inflation? Well, at the moment, the answer is, hey, we actually need some inflation. We're trying to cause prices.
And also, Steve, sorry to interrupt you again, but we've had all this quantitative easing, massive injections of cash without inflation.
It hasn't actually gone into the financials, into our accounts. This is why you've got to have a double entry bookkeeping style approach to the way you think about the economy, which is why I've developed a software package to support that called Minsky. Because when the government buys, if you want to increase money in the economy, you've got to put into your bank account and my bank account. If you put it into the bank's bank account at the central bank, that's going on the asset side of the bank's ledger. It doesn't turn up on the liability side in the sense of something you and I can spend. It just swaps one asset for another with them.
Was it inevitable, do you think, that the Eurozone was going to start doing quantitative easing as it has this year?
Inevitable in the sense that everything else they've done has failed. Let's try something else that might moderately work, but it won't be any. It's not what they need. They need to reduce the level of private debt, which caused their crisis in the first place, and they need quantitative easing for the people, not buying the bonds off banks, but taking debt off the public and injecting that money into the economy. And that's, as you're saying, that's the same taboo that they're ignoring, that the Americans have also not followed through on because of their various taboos about the monetary system that, you know, they shouldn't have taboos about the monetary system because they don't bloody well think about it in the first place.
Quantitative easing, though, isn't it really effectively counterfeiting? Because they have a license. It's almost as if someone's given them a license to print banknotes.
Well, both the government and the banks have that license, and we have to understand what its limitations are.
Can I have one?
No, you can't. You'd be in jail for counterfeiting. So fundamentally, what you need, if you say, I want to go make some money, when people say that, they don't want to go down to the back shed and run off a few Roni-owed pound notes. They mean I'm going to work harder and try to capture some of the ones that currently exist. But the only ones, people who can actually create money that way are the banks, and they create money by creating a loan, and the government, which creates money by running a deficit. So those are the two, so if you like, legal forms of counterfeiting that exist in our society.
Amazing. Legal counterfeiting. Okay, so, yeah, and they seem to be hooked on it right now. What about this whole business of deflation we're hearing about this week from the Bank of England? What does that mean?
Well, deflation, you know, in the simplest term, is falling prices. The reason that's dangerous, and this is not what conventional economists say because they don't understand, again, the role of debt, deflation is dangerous because when prices fall, incomes also fall, but your level of debt remains the same. So you have a smaller income on which to service the existing debt. And that's what was the great danger of deflation. It actually increases the real burden of debt. If you have, say, prices falling by, say, 5% per annum, which is feasible with the way we're going right now, that means your actual interest rate, which might be, say, 3% nominal, is actually 8% in real terms. And that becomes a crushing burden when you have a huge level of debt, as we have in the private sector already. So that's the real danger, that then leads to people trying to pay their debts down. And by paying their debts down, they're reducing the amount of money in circulation as well. So it becomes a vicious spiral. That's what Irving Fisher saw back in the 1930s, and it's what we've managed to recreate by our fetish about reducing the inflation rate while ignoring the level of private debt.
Martin, what are your thoughts about where this deflation is heading?
Well, the danger is that it becomes, you reach a critical mass and everything starts to implode. I mean, I'd like to hear what Steve's views are on the potential for a further crash, because I keep suggesting week after week on this programme that this is definitely a possibility. And I think, you know, the part of the problem is to do with intellectual failure in mathematics and elsewhere, because of course complex systems don't function in the way that they're suggesting. But also, of course, there are vested interests. Once you've bailed out the financial services sector, they are then in a position to blackmail for further resources, which is the classic reason given by people like Friedman for not bailing out failing industries in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I see another crash being likely in America's case, the next 3 to 5 years. China's case, less than two. Because again, it comes back to the role of rising levels of private debt. In America, the private debt level peaked at about 160% of GDP. That's private non-financial sector debt, so not the debt of financial corporations like Citibank to the normal banks. It's the debt of companies and households. And then it fell to about 140% of GDP. And it's now rising again. Now, it gives you an idea that the debt level in America began after the Second World War at about 35-40%. So we're carrying 4 to 5 times the debt burden of back then, and we're trying to have a revival. I think within about 2 to 4 to 5 years at most, we'll be back at the same level of debt we had back at the peak of the crisis, and the same story will apply: people's inability to take on more debt. Lots of debt loans going bad anyway, another crunch then. But China is actually the next one to look at, because they got through the financial crisis by basically telling their private banks to lend money. And of course, in the Communist Party, with the political power that they've got over the system, banks do what the Communist Party tells them to do. So you had private lending just exploding, and China's private debt ratio went from 100% of GDP in about 2009 to 180% at the beginning of this year, and rising rapidly. And that is going to have to slow down, and when it slows down, China will have a crunch. So the first crisis is likely to come in China, followed by, you know, what it then does to the already pretty fragile financial systems in the rest of the world.
Steve, I wonder what your thoughts are about how to fix it all, because there's all sorts of people analysing this is going to be a disaster, that is going to be a disaster, and actually it sort of repels most people. It repels me. I think, well, what, do I really want to even try and understand this? Anyway, what are your thoughts if you were sitting in George Osborne's shoes and you were right at the start of a new term in May, or whoever is in the Chancellor of the Exchequer's job, what would you be doing to put things back on track? Because ultimately, what most people care about is disposable income. You want to have at least a reasonable amount to survive. You don't want to be working all hours God sends, and you can't even pay the bills.
You're paying the debt's the main problem, because when you pay the debt, you can't afford to pay your bills. What I'd be doing is what I'd call a modern debt jubilee.
Are you talking about default or what?
Yeah, well, default's part of it, but if you've got a huge debt servicing problem, you're trying to reduce your debt levels, and that when you reduce that debt, rather than it being like, you know, spending down at the shop, which, you know, continues to circulate, you're taking money out of circulation. So that's the real danger of a debt crisis.
Now, you mentioned the jubilee. What do you mean by that?
We had all societies up to the feudal times had this idea of abolishing debt on a regular basis. It began back in the Sumerian civilizations, 5,000 years ago, because debt would tend to accumulate. Private debt, people would end up in debt slavery, and that would actually challenge the viability of the society. So the emperor would actually decree that every 49 years or every change of a ruler, they would wipe out all the debts, which would free all the debt slaves, etc., etc. We reckon we're too fancy for that, but in fact we've got ourselves caught up probably in the highest level of private debt in human history now. So I think we need to have a debt jubilee to wipe it off. But the barrier people have about that is twofold. One is that they think, well, if you bail out the debtors, what about the people who save money? Because there are also people who save money. What do they get? And are we going to have moral hazard? And won't it all happen all over again? Which is the second point. My argument is to say, first of all, let's use the government's capacity to create money, to inject money directly into people's savings accounts, but on condition that if you have debt, you must cancel that debt. So anybody who's in debt simply gets their debt reduced, whereas people who are savers get a cash injection from the government. And then at the same time, you've got to control the banking sector so it can't lend to finance Ponzi schemes again, like the subprime bubble and so on. And say, have rules that, like saying that rather than lending being based allegedly on the income of the borrower, base the income or the maximum loan also on the income earning capacity of the asset being purchased. So limit the amount of lending not on the basis of the loan to valuation ratio of the property being purchased when you're buying a house, but say make it something like, say, no more than 10 times, the loan being no more than 10 times the estimated rental income of the property being purchased. And that would reduce the extent to which banks end up financing positive feedback loops that give us bubbles in asset prices.
Okay.
Also, then force the banks to lend, to businesses rather than speculators.
Also, in the background of all of this, of course, today is the discussions going on between the Troika and this new Syriza party in Greece. How do you think that's going to go, and what can we learn from what's going on there?
Oh, well, that's a classic case. You talk about intellectual failure. That's the classic description of what's been happening with the Eurozone all the way through. It's an intellectually stupid idea to bring about the Euro. They're defending it vigorously, and they're trying to push Syriza to continue accepting an austerity program, which is actually causing a Great Depression in southern Europe. I really don't know. We're going to find out today which way they go, because we're still waiting on finding out what the deal is.
Well, that's right. Negotiations are continuing, but let's just assume that they do come to some sort of arrangement with the European Central Bank, and that they do have some kind of rearrangement and renegotiation and a rollover. What do you think is going to happen? And do you think eventually they will go back to the drachma?
I know, having spoken to people and caught up in Syriza, they are trying desperately to avoid that, because they can see the chaos that might come out of that transition. My attitude is, I've always been, the euro is always a bad idea, and we have to find a way of unwinding it. But unwinding it is doing as little damage as possible.
Haven't the Greeks kind of almost given up their sovereignty by going over to the euro?
Well, they have. This is the trouble. It's a crazy idea, because normally if you give up sovereignty, you want something back in return. Well, the ironic thing, when you people signed up for the euro, they gave away their monetary sovereignty, and they agreed to limit their fiscal power as well. So the only way to make this sustainable is to allow the European Central Bank to let governments have more than a 3% of GDP deficit and have an accumulated debt level of more than 60%, and then also start writing off some of this private debt. But they're so far from that, it's not funny. So my feeling is you're going to have to get caught in a worse version of what Japan's been through. Bear in mind, Japan's been caught in a debt deflation for 25 years now, but have, you know, a substantial downturn in Europe, the sort of political turmoil that comes out of it, and then in that middle of chaos, hopefully we'll get some sensible decisions about what to do. But in the meantime, the capacity of Europeans to make a bad situation worse can't be underestimated.
Well, doesn't that sort of put into question your suggestion earlier that the crash will come from China or from the US further down the line? If the euro unravels in a disorderly fashion, as it may well do this week and next week, won't that trigger all these derivative contracts which depend upon Greece not defaulting and so on? And isn't that what Varoufakis, in a way, is trying to play poker with these people and say, look, if you push us out of the euro, you know the consequences, the banking system will implode, just for a tiny little country like Greece, never mind a slowdown in China.
Yeah, I know. You look at the... what's amazing is just how rigid the Europeans and the Germans in particular are being over this, how pig-headed, and just not admitting that they designed a bad system. Their austerity policy is exactly the wrong way to cope with what's gone wrong with that system. And now they're playing brinkmanship, not realising the consequences for their financial system. It's ridiculous to watch.
Steve, what about following your work? I mean, books, maybe book titles, stuff you've written, and also whereabouts people can find you online.
Yeah, well, the main thing is I have my blog has always been called debtdeflation.com/logs. I'm now publishing on Forbes magazine, so what you see is a link normally from my blog through to Forbes. I put some other stuff on my blog as well, like videos and talks and stuff like that. So the debtdeflation.com/blogs. Probably place is the first one to start. Then you can search for me on Forbes. And my main book is called Debunking Economics. For those who are technical, they might look at a book I edited some time ago called Commerce, Complexity and Evolution. It talks about a sort of general philosophy and also mathematical approaches to modeling complex systems. And then if you want to do an interesting Masters in Economics, come to Kingston University, London.
Why is it that there are so few economists like you, Steve, that talk like this, and that the whole, it seems, almost all economists, I suppose we're going back to the right at the start, really, do not get that they need to have some kind of revolution in the way they do things?
I think it's what you might call a mind virus. If you read any of Richard Dawkins's work about the selfish gene, one thing he argued was this idea of what you might call the selfish meme, a mental attitude, a thought that gets in people's heads, and they then reorganize how they think about the real world through that vision all the time. And this vision of an equilibrium system, an equilibrium barter system as a way of modeling capitalism, has become so ingrained in economists that the majority of the profession continues reproducing that without even thinking there's an alternative way of doing it. On the outside of us, those of us who've got more exposure to modern mathematical methods and a bit more of philosophy as well think, how on earth can you be so deluded? But they just reproduce themselves through graduate programs and the whole edifice of economic research which they control, which means people like myself don't get much funding. So it just seems to be reproduction of a bad idea, and never underestimate the capacity of a bad idea to persist through time.
Can I just ask, presumably you're familiar with the mathematician Benoit Mandelbrot, who wrote a book about the significance of his discoveries in mathematics for mainstream economics. And I suggest to you that mainstream economists have got mathematics, they've not kept up with modern mathematics.
Well, nothing like it. I mean, there's a colleague of mine, Tony Lawson, who is given what's called the critical realism approach to economic theory, and he blames mathematics for the problems in economics. And my argument back to Tony, who's a good friend, is say that what economists call mathematics, I would actually call mathematics. When they get results they don't like, they pretend they're not there, they ignore them, and they stick with the mathematical approach, which is a good half century out of date. And resistant to the modern concepts in complex systems. So, they have locked themselves away with a primitive way of thinking about the world, and And only when they get radically wrong about reality, as in by missing the financial crisis, is there any chance for change in the profession. But even then, you're fighting enormous resistance. People hang on to these ideas more desperately than they hang on to life in some ways.
Amazing. Anyway, Debt Deflation's your blog. Thanks ever so much for joining us, Steve Keen from Kingston University.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Okay, Martin, we've had the successful, it seems, I mean, it's just about to do a holding, ceasefire in Ukraine this week. What are your thoughts about that and whether it's likely to hold a bit longer?
Well, I don't know if it is holding, Tony. I mean, it's hour to hour. We're getting new information about it. I think we can see a potential way out of the crisis here. If the Kiev regime is put under pressure by its masters in Brussels, and the Americans are basically and the British are told to keep out of it, it's possible that a deal may emerge. But at the same time, I'm not very hopeful, because in the US there's a general view that they're going to arm the Ukrainians, and that's what's going to happen, whatever anybody in Europe thinks.
Well, we've seen
and of course that will just pour petrol on the bonfire.
Because it's exactly a year since we were sitting in this studio and watching events at Maidan Square. There's been very little reporting of this as a coup. Is there any doubt that it was a military coup?
Well, not in serious circles. We talked earlier about the Ghouta chemical weapons attack of 2 years ago, but the evidence for of the sniper attack in the Maidan Square a year ago today, there was a telephone intercept which was pretty much immediately put in the public domain and verified as genuine by Umas Piets, the Estonian foreign minister, and Catherine Ashton, the EU's foreign spokesperson, which pointed the finger very firmly at elements within the current regime, particularly Andrei Paribi, who is the head of Pravi Sector, as being the source of the snipers which shot both police officers and protesters, and which of course fits a pattern of NATO provocations
that
we've seen both in Syria and Venezuela.
Paribi,
in the last two, 3 years.
Paribi was then made Defence Minister of Ukraine, wasn't he? And he was in charge when the airliner was shot down, and mysteriously, without saying why, resigned 3 weeks after the airliner
was
indeed. Shot down.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, a bit like the chemical weapons attack at Ghouta, not only was it not carried out by the rebels and the Russians, it was carried out by elements within NATO's intelligence services. They are the terrorists. And at some point, the police in Italy and elsewhere are going to catch up with them. But of course the mainstream media still, based on even the liberal media, has got a completely distorted view of what's been going on. The terrorist attack in the Ukraine on this, a year ago today, all of the evidence points to it being carried out by snipers connected with Pravi Sector, far-right paramilitaries who are working closely with NATO intelligence services.
Well,
they shot the liberal protesters.
Just a couple of minutes ago on the BBC, Ukraine is accusing Russia over the Maidan 2014 killings.
Well, they're all accusing each other, but the evidence is already out there. The shootings were all with same calibre weapons. They were carried out by professional snipers, and they were carried out from buildings which were already under the control of the far-right paramilitaries. And the far-right paramilitaries, of course, have been working very closely with the CIA and MI6, so they didn't just do it off their own bat.
Talking of coups, calling of coup d'etats, there was one in Venezuela recently.
Indeed.
Which was foiled.
Failed.
And also there's been a regime change in Yemen.
Yeah, well, if you come to Venezuela in the first place, last year, one of the things that was happening was that snipers were shooting both police officers and protesters as a means of trying to undermine the Maduro government in Venezuela. And NATO intelligence services have got a track record of using this kind of provocation. Similar things happened in Syria. We had protests against the regime, and then mysterious snipers opened up both on police officers and protesters. In other words, there's a pattern here, and that pattern is NATO intelligence services.
Also, going across the other side of the Atlantic, the Argentinians are demanding an independent judiciary. In a huge street march, this is a couple of days ago, yep. Protesters holding up signs that read, We want the truth, and this is to do with having an independent judiciary, as the country reels from the death of the state prosecutor who had been investigating the president.
Well, there's a big story here which is very difficult to go into. It's related to the bombing of the Israeli community centre in 1994, I think it was.
That's right, in
Argentina.
Yeah.
The Hezbollah and Iran were blamed for carrying it out, but I'm afraid that the evidence again suggests that this was carried out probably by Mossad in terms of trying to undermine.
Well, why on earth would Mossad bomb a synagogue?
Because they're part of the same NATO game plan as the rest of them. What was actually happening is that Yitzhak Rabin, who was the Prime Minister of Israel, was trying to make peace with the Palestinians, and they wanted to try and up the ante, kill some random Jewish people in Argentina in order to try and undermine Rabin's position. And then Rabin, of course, was then subsequently assassinated by a lone gunman. Or again, probably linked to the intelligence services. This kind of game of false flag terrorism, we've discussed it umpteen times on this show. We really need to get people to understand, when an incident happens, do not presume you know what's happened. Suspend judgment until you have all the facts.
Okay, well, something did happen, didn't it, in Copenhagen in Denmark at the weekend. A suspect was released from prison 2 weeks before the attack.
Well, isn't that strange that we've got all these random attacks, one in Ottawa, one in Sydney, one in Copenhagen, one in Paris, and they're all completely different individuals, all of whom happen to be, let's say, confused kind of patsy-type individuals. It's not like a kind of orchestrated conspiracy, but they've all got similarities. They've all had troubles with the law. They've all got drug and alcohol issues. They've all converted to Islam very recently, and then of course they get shot dead, so we can't put them on trial and find out what really went on. This all fits the pattern, as I've said before, of Gladio style NATO false flag operations, as investigated by the Italian police force over 30 years. It's quite clear the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Imposimato, who's going to be standing potentially for president of Italy, police have investigated this in Italy. They pointed the finger firmly at NATO intelligence services for the bombing of Bologna railway station, the assassination of Aldo Moro, the bombing of Piazza Fontana. People in Italy know what I'm talking about. People in Ireland will remember the bombings of Dublin and Monaghan in 1972, which the Garda Síochána are quite firmly convinced was carried out by elements within British intelligence.
So this guy was, again, like the Sydney attack, for example, on the top of the terror watch list and the Paris one, but somehow he managed to get hold of an assault rifle and two handguns.
Well, so, supposedly, but what happens is he gets shot dead and his name is used as the person who did it. Now, what looks like happened in the Charlie Hebdo business, that was a professional hit by professional military-trained people. And then, of course, what they do is they claim they found the identity document of one of the Carracci brothers in the getaway car, and then of course they immediately, the Carracci brothers will have been chosen because they've got a history of Islamist extremist ideas, and then of course they're surrounded and shot, and that's the end of that. So they did it, they're dead now, end of discussion. But of course it's not clear that they did do it, as was pointed out by the head of the president of Turkey, Erdogan. He questioned what was going on there. Of course in Turkey this kind of NATO provocation is absolutely, everybody knows about it. NATO engages in provocational terrorism. It's just everybody, every cafe in Istanbul, they know this. It's a fact. The Ergonokan network linked to the Turkish armed forces. Now, but you don't hear this in mainstream media in the West. But that's not because it's not true. It's just because we don't want to talk about it.
Representing the entire city, this is BCFM. BCFM 93.2.
And now I'm joined by David Powell from Friends of the Earth. Hi, David. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Good evening, Tony. How are you?
Yeah. What's the latest with Hinkley Power Station, Hinkley 3?
Crikey. Well, what's going on? Where to start? Poor ill-fated Hinkley. So the latest thing is that EDF Energy, who are the French company, the only one left standing who are in the running to build the 25 billion euro power plant, have had to quietly announce that actually perhaps it's going to take a bit longer to get it ready than they thought. It's been delayed and delayed. I've been on here before talking about the various hurdles, so it had to go through a year-long European challenge when the European Commission looked at it. Now Austria, who are really anti-nuclear, are coming out very strongly saying they're going to challenge the decision to give it the go-ahead. Funders have dropped out. Other power plants that EDF Energy has owned, other nuclear ones, have developed massive cracks in them. Over in France and Finland, they're massively behind schedule. The costs keep going up and up and up. And this is for a plant that's still, you know, going to take a good 10 years to even get off the ground.
Is it going to happen?
Every time you come on here, you ask me that, and every time I say the same thing, which is it looks a little bit less likely than it did the last time.
Okay, well,
there's an awful lot behind it, though, Tony. I mean, the government really wanted it to happen. So,
but this, but they're kind of running out of steam, aren't they? They've only got a few months to run.
A few months of this government, yeah, and then who knows what the next lot will do, as you were saying earlier.
Okay, also, we've just been talking about Ukraine there and other things, but particularly with Ukraine, I mean, everyone's pretty much used to understanding that what goes on in the Middle East has got a lot to do with Western oil interests, but what about Ukraine? Are there any sort of, I know, I'm wondering, are these Ukrainian rebels sitting on a gas field or something like that, or an oil field?
Well, the oil price is... It's so central to everything, isn't it? It's one of the things we campaign against, climate change. You know, we want to see greener economies. Sometimes you forget how important the oil price is as a geopolitical thing. So look at Russia and Ukraine. Look what's going on there. The Russian economy is massively hurting at the moment. But the main reason it's massively hurting is not really the sanctions and anything to do with Ukraine. It's the oil price, which has absolutely fallen through the floor, as you know. 45%, so almost half of all the taxes that Putin gets, he gets from selling oil. It accounts for about half of Russia's entire export. So anything that gets in the way of that makes him jumpy. And I think if you trace the conflict in Ukraine all the way back, take it back, you know, 5-10 years, it's all about access to oil, access to gas, going through Ukraine and all the tensions around that. Oil's at the heart of just about everything when it comes to geopolitics, particularly when it comes out of Russia.
Amazing. Anyway, I'm also joined by Indra Donafrancesco. Hi, Indra.
Hi.
Welcome to the Politics Show. Indra, you're from an organisation called Earth First, and Earth First has got its winter meeting here in Bristol. And one of your specialities is direct action. Now, in a way, it's quite nice having David here too, because quite a lot of what he's campaigning on, people tear their hair out and they say, well, hang on a minute, they've made a ridiculous decision here, it's bad for the environment. But you don't just simply accept that, do you? You will sometimes take direct action.
Yes, hello, thank you, Tony. It's nice to be on here. Yes, instead of tearing your hair out, it's you looking at a project which the government or the local council have announced, and it involves tearing down somewhere you love in your back garden or even in the next fields or community spot, and you think you need to do something about it. And even if you think you've gone through all the legal processes and still you haven't been able to stop it, the only thing left to do is put yourself in front of the machinery. And it's an incredibly liberating experience.
Well, I remember years ago reading a book by Edward Abbey, I think it's called The Monkey Wrench Gang, which was one of the things which inspired a lot of people to start Earth First over in the US. But just give us some of your experience of doing this and whether it's been successful or not.
Direct action in this country. Well, in the 90s, there was a huge road building scheme that was set about by Thatcher, biggest since the Romans. It was going through ancient woodlands, ancient monuments, triple SSIs, and it was going to carve through loads of countryside. And through direct action, I think there might have been about 6 projects out of 48 that were actually completed, till it ground to a halt. And direct action not only is good for a community and good for yourself, it actually shows people that you can stop things, and it puts it on the media and it shows people what are happening. So when the prime ministers are taking backhanders on all these projects and knowing what the governments are doing, then people can actually say, no, we're watching. And we can stop it.
Well, it's nice to hear that you can actually change things through direct action. But when you say it's good for the community, what do you mean by that?
Community can sometimes feel very very despondent about things, and they don't know how to go forward, and they've trusted in people that they voted for. So when communities come together, especially now, I mean, you've been talking about the austerity measures, and community buildings are going, hospitals are going, schools are going, and people who have trusted, who have put their trust in the authority, are now seeing that it was misplaced. It's a way of people coming together. We've been so disparate as communities. This is a way of grouping and of talking together and sharing ideas.
Okay, so what is Earth First up to this weekend? Are you, you know, what kind of, have you taken over a building, a meeting? Just give us an idea of what you're up to.
No, we're in a community centre. We're in the Cabele, which is a social centre in Bristol.
That's it, and, in Robertson Road, isn't
it? That's it, Robertson
Road.
Oh,
you used to live there years ago.
Did you?
Yes,
oh, my word. You probably remember. Yes, it's the Cabele has been there for over 20 years.
It was originally squatted.
It was. And after a while, they got it for peppercorn. I think they got it for about £1.
Well, it was a bit more than that, but it certainly was well below the market rent for a market rate for a building like that. But
yes, anyway, so and they turned it into a co-op. So basically,
sort of
we meet. Earth First has been going in this country for over 20 years, and we have summer gatherings, we have winter gatherings, and we're not a cohesive campaign. We're just groups of people who come together and to talk about direct action. So we'll be going. Will be different groups: Opencast Coal, Fracking, GM, Nuclear Power, New Road Building and Quarries, discussions on those. The latest legal approaches, the latest sort of infiltration or private security, media, how to help with...
Now, hang on, that's an interesting one, isn't it? Because quite a lot of groups like yours, I mean, have been infiltrated over the years, and we've discovered that the police have even had kids with some of the protesters, some of whom have actually not even broken the law.
Yes.
It's pretty horrific. I mean, how on earth does a movement cope with that sort of thing? And I wonder if you've managed to use the law to, you know, to actually help find out who these people are and possibly even get them prosecuted.
There is a case going on at the moment with, I think, about four of the police infiltrators. They've been going on for a while. They've tried to decimate campaign groups.
I mean, is there any idea of, have you been able to figure out exactly what kind of campaigns the police have been targeting with this infiltration?
All campaigns. I mean, the thing is, it's not about figuring it out. You've just got to accept it happens. Of course it happens. I mean, it was when the police were infiltrating, we knew to expect that and for it to happen. I don't think we expected the lengths that they went to and the uncontrolled extent they were, you know, by their handlers, how it was just a free range. They have totally decimated communities and people's lives. But we refuse to let that to let that decimate us as campaign groups.
And it's good that you managed to keep your morale up despite that. Martin Summers, I wonder what you've got, if you've got anything to say about the way that the police has been used in this way, actually against groups, many of whom have not actually broken the law at all.
Well, I would suggest that that's a lot of what's been going on is frankly illegal. And when the police behave illegally, they need to be investigated and prosecuted. We mentioned Inspector Chris Covington earlier, who tried to foment a riot in Downing Street. He didn't get any. He was identified, and a complaint was sent by Stop the War to the Metropolitan Police, saying, look, this guy was trying to foment a riot. Are you going to do anything about it? Nothing was done. Now, the point is that we need a police force, we need laws, and we need them to be properly enforced. But if the police are breaking the law, as I would suggest they were doing in these cases, then they should be prosecuted and sent to prison.
And Indra mentioned fracking there, David. I wonder what you think from an economics point of view and Friends of the Earth point of view. I mean, we've had a little look at Hinkley, but what about the fracking? Is that going to be a revolution that unfolds across the Mendip Hills?
I mean, this is where the stuff that Indra is doing crosses right over with national economic stuff. There's only one thing that is stopping fracking taking off in the way the government want it to, and that is people resisting it. People in Bulcombe, people up in Lancashire. There's a huge, huge outrage on the ground where these companies actually want to come and drill for shale gas. And it's causing the councils to think again. It's causing the planning inspectors to think again. It's causing the government to think up yet more and more financial bungs to give to the community. And every time it happens, it makes it a little bit more expensive for the frackers. It makes a little bit more delay. And it really, really does matter. It's all perfectly legal. Protesting against something that is hugely unpopular anyway, and particularly when people are doing it in your backyard. The Mendips is one of the places in the front line. The protests will come here at some point, and I'm sure Indra's group and people like them will be up in arms against it. But you can stop this stuff if you get enough people to make enough noise about it.
Well, I mean, the thing with fracking is it seems to be, I mean, quite an emotional campaign where you don't want these people to be drilling in an area which is beautiful. But is there anything really sort of solid evidence against what, you know, for example, health things like that to do with fracking?
Yeah, I mean, so there's all sorts of reasons why people don't want it. So there's the big, you know, we don't want any more fossil fuels, thanks very much, what about climate change reasons? There's not wanting huge amounts of lorries coming into your area. There are some more NIMBY sort of concerns as well. But there's huge concerns about what happens to your groundwater, what happens to your local environment. Yeah, you're building a fossil fuel drilling rig in some quite beautiful places. You're going a kilometre down, you're going through aquifers, you're coming a kilometre up again. No one quite knows the impact that's going to have. What they do know is they can't guarantee it without exceptionally tight regulation that it won't seep into your drinking water and it won't have impacts on local people. And the government don't want to bring in that exceptionally tight regulation because obviously then no one's going to want to frack. And people won't stand for it, I don't think.
What about the earthquakes?
Yeah, well, so there were the early exploratory stuff off the coast of Blackpool, wasn't it? Recorded a couple of category something earthquakes, which makes sense. You know, think about what you're actually doing. You're drilling down a kilometre under the ground, and then you're drilling a kilometre sideways. You're pumping at extreme huge pressure, chemicals and Lord knows what else, to squeeze out gas, all of which has to be done kind of without people noticing it too much. But of course it's going to cause some sort of movement in the ground. It's not at all surprising. And again, you know, there's the government talks about things being an acceptable level of earth tremor, an acceptable level of water pollution. Well, I don't think people think that sort of stuff is acceptable, particularly not when it's right on their doorstep.
Indra, I wonder if you could just tell us what is your particular. I mean, you've got lots going on this weekend. Have you got any particular favourites of talks or whatever that you're going to be learning, or workshops, that kind of thing?
Well, what we do this winter gathering, it's very much about planning and being strategic for the summer. So one of the things we are talking about is the summer gathering, which is going to be, that's an outdoor event with a few hundred people. It's in the Peak District this year, and it's going to be inviting the communities from the sites where the fracking is being proposed and where the planning is. And we're talking about amazing normal communities, people, housewives coming in, and they've said enough is enough, and we want to learn how to stop it. And we're inviting them, communities from the fracking, from Blackpool, from Lancaster, and from Bolcombe, to come and actually see how to blockade and how to do proper climbing.
Okay, David, climbing.
Well, this is the thing, isn't it, that I think people maybe have an outdated stereotypical image of what an environmental protester looks like, but actually the people, you know, the people who are on the ground protesting against fracking all around the country right now are quote normal people. They are housewives. I can't believe I said housewives. They are mothers, they are families, they are normal people. They are teachers, they're people who work in normal jobs. This is where I think we're at now with protest in this country. I think this has actually become something that people are really, really upset about.
I know. I struggle to find a better word than normal. But, yeah, people... Right. And honestly, the state will be a lot more afraid of those communities than they ever were of protesters up trees. I mean, they want to learn, you know, the legal position. They want public order situations, how not to panic, what their rights are.
But, of course, most people really would be afraid to go into a situation where they could be arrested. I mean, you know, how do you...
Exactly.
I mean, do you actually help people to sort of see, well, this might happen, that might happen, and
absolutely.
Your rights are?
Totally, give them all the options.
Do you have any rights?
Give them all the options. Yes, people do have rights, and they don't realise how much rights they actually have, and also about what is an arrestable situation, whether they want to be arrested, whether they don't want to be arrested. That's, that's not what direct action is, not about being arrested. It's teaching people how not to panic, and they are a lot more afraid of them than they ever were of protesters.
Okay, anything else on the horizon? We've had in the last few years fracking, this sort of thing.
Yes, the road programme is back.
Is it?
Government is, part of the infrastructure. Probably they've put out 772 new miles of new road across the country. That basically would cross from Land's End to John O'Groats. And that's going through more ancient monuments, woodlands, Triplice Eyes. And trunk roads that aren't needed. I mean, there was an assessment that came out. Basically, the Committee of Trunk Road Assessment, Advisory Committee, said an average road improvement for which traffic growth due to all other factors is forecast correctly, we see an additional, i.e. increased, 10% of base traffic in the short term and 20% in the long term. Basically, that means the more roads you build, the more traffic there will be.
But Martin, sounds like you've got your infrastructure, public spending, and we're going to actually get the economy going again.
Well, it depends. What we need to do is rethink everything that we're doing and invest in infrastructure which is genuinely sustainable, not just more of the same that we've done previously. This is a time of great crisis and change. We mentioned fracking earlier, and of course the oil price going down. This is to do with the Saudis, with the Americans trying to create pressure on Assad, trying to create pressure on Putin. These are very dangerous times, but these times are also opportunities where we can start to ask the real questions about what kind of society we want to live in and how we're going to get there. And there is every there, you know, there's every reason for us to start making the demands that need to be made about the society we want to see in a generation from now. Now is the time to make those demands.
Indra, most people just don't have the time to do this kind of thing. How on earth do you manage to afford the time to spend a bit of time, you know, actually campaigning on this and take time out of your life to do, you know, the gathering here this weekend? Because where most of us have very, very little spare time, working all the hours God sends, hardly being able to pay the bills. And I just wonder how people can manage to do this, to actually spend time on actually campaigning on something, even if it is quite local. It's a big slice out of your leisure time, isn't it?
No, you are so right. You're so right. And with so few people doing it, yes, the time is more condensed. I mean, back in the 90s at the major road protest, at Newbury, were hundreds of people. I mean, people took their time out of universities. They took their time out of their work, and they focused on it, and they gave their all to that, and it did stop it, but it did totally give your all. I mean, my children are grown up now. I work part-time. It isn't something that everyone can do, but there is something that everyone can do. You know, it's not all about sitting up trees, it's not all about digging tunnels or living on camps. It's about supporting those people that are, and certainly about sharing the information of why they're down there. I mean, it can be a very lonely place. We even thought about, you know, doing a supporter protester, you know, where you can actually be a sponsor for people. So, you know, to share their experiences and maybe help that way.
Well, we've got this occupation up at Stapleton Allotments as well, haven't we, over the Metro bus. I wonder if you're going to be spending a bit of time up there.
I'd really like to. There's things still happening down at Coombe Haven Defenders, down in Hastings, where a road is nearly completed, but that went through an outrageous amount of wildlife and ecology.
And if anyone's interested in popping along, just give us an idea again whereabouts you are this weekend.
Oh, we are in Robertson Street. We're at the Cabele Centre, which is, I think it's two stops from the Bristol, yeah, Stapleton
it's
Road.
Just near the Black Swan pub on Stapleton Road, if people
That's
know
That's the
it.
One, yes.
And you're there from when till when?
We're there from tonight till Sunday about 4 o'clock, so there'll be workshops, and we're very happy if you just want to pop in.
So will Friends of the Earth be down there, David? Will you be down?
Not sure I'll be down there myself, Tony, but we absolutely support everything that's going on. And hopefully we're doing our bit to coordinate a lot of national level stuff as well.
Okay, Indra and David, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
Finally, we finish on Martin's favourite subject. This is the Italian general Gendel Matteleon, who was talking about NATO blowing up ordinary people like you and me in Italy.
We have one general. It's Gendelio Maletti. He's former head of the Italian Counterintelligence Unit. And he said in 2001 at the Piazza Fontana trial, he actually said, you know, American terrorism is a reality in Europe. And it's scary what he said. He said, the CIA, following the directives of its government, wanted to create an Italian nationalist capable of halting what it saw a slide to the left. And for this purpose, it may have made use of right-wing terrorism. That's his quote. And, you know, he was a member of the Italian Secret Service, and he obviously was accused, you know, by Italians who said, why do you carry out terrorism against our mothers and against our children, against our the elderly in the country? Are you insane? You know, you should be in prison. And he said, come on, I'm not the one to blame. I mean, I'm acting in a global network. And he said, you know, at the time when Nixon was in charge, and Nixon, you know, wanted to fight communism, and he may have made use of right-wing terrorism. That's how Maletti says it. And for us as historians, it's very hard to find out what the truth is. I mean, in 1969, when this terrorist attack occurred, I wasn't even born. So I'm looking at the data, and I'm trying to figure out who fooled whom.
Okay, all the links are up at thisweek.org.uk. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
The Hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, police are trying to trace three school friends who they believe have run away from home in East London to go to Syria. The girls, who are aged 15 and 16, travelled to Gatwick Airport on Tuesday and boarded a flight to Turkey. It's feared that they may end up as so-called jihadi brides to Islamic State militants. Anra Koka, who campaigns against extremism, fears they've been groomed online.
They've been sold this amazing fantasy story that to be a good Muslim, the best thing to do is possibly, you know, get involved in these wars. And then they're vulnerable. They're just completely brainwashed. And the next thing they do is they leave the country.
Two more Chelsea fans have been suspended from Stamford Bridge over the France racism row. Five people have now been banned from entering the ground following Tuesday's incidents on the Paris Metro. A black man was repeatedly pushed off a train onto the platform as racist chants came from the carriage. Chelsea manager Jose Mourinho has condemned the scenes.
We feel ashamed, but maybe we shouldn't, because I refuse to be connected with these people. I'm connected with Chelsea, I'm connected with so many good things this club represents. I'm a proud Chelsea Football Club manager because I know what the club is.
EU finance ministers are understood to have drafted an outline agreement which could form the basis for extending Greece's bailout loan. The country's new government is desperate to loosen austerity measures to revive its economy. A music teacher from one of the country's most prestigious art schools in London has been jailed for 11 years for historical sex attacks on two schoolgirls and a young woman. An Old Bailey judge said Philip Pickett was guilty of exceptionally serious sexual offences. Nearly £860 million is being invested in the next generation of Royal Navy ships. They're going to be built on the Clyde, and the deal will safeguard 1,700 jobs across the UK. And scientists say they've come up with a form of dark chocolate that can get rid of wrinkles. The makers of Estiachoc claim that it can transform the skin of a 50 to 60 year old into that of someone in their 20s or 30s. That's the latest from the Sky News Centre. I'm Chris Giles.